2595 C, lawyer who has appeared before us many times and was here yesterday. Feinmeier, who is Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, representing the state of Wisconsin in this case. Mr. Kleinmeier.
May it please the court, for the record, my name is Stephen Kleinmeier, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin, the plaintiff appellant petitioner in this case. This case is here to review a decision of the Court of Appeals that affirmed the trial court's order suppressing the evidence in the case. The issues in the case are concerned with the execution of a no-knock search warrant in Beloit. There's very few facts in the record concerning the execution of the warrant itself, but everyone agreed at the trial court that it was executed in a no-knock fashion. The challenge was to the information, the sufficiency of the information that the police had that would justify a no-knock entry. The standard for the no-knock is they can make a no-knock entry if the police have reasonable suspicion under particular circumstances that knocking and announcing would be dangerous to them. That's the issue in this case, the danger. The information in the warrant affidavit, that this was issued as a no-knock warrant, the information in the affidavit that was provided to justify the no-knock warrant is basically two different types of information. One was the police officer cited his experience in executing search warrants and the fact that in drug-related crimes, the occupants often arm themselves with weapons, including firearms, and sometimes use those weapons against police and others. The more particular information in this case involved the arrest records of two of the occupants. The affidavit alleged that one occupant had been arrested in Illinois in 1989 for aggravated assault. The other occupant had been arrested nine times for larceny, three times for obstruction, for obstructing, and twice for assault.
Counsel, yeah. I would like to ask about your framing of the issue before you start discussing the issue. The way that you framed the issue, and you just indicated that moments ago, is also set forth on page 6 of your brief, and you said it virtually verbatim. That is, the information in the search warrant affidavit provided a reasonable suspicion that knocking and announcing before entering to execute the warrant would be dangerous. On page 7 of your brief, you cite the Richards case. And the Richards case, at the bottom of that page 7, it has the language would be dangerous or futile, or that it would inhibit the effective investigation of the crime. Now let me pause to make sure you're on the same page as that I am. Do you understand
yes.
What I read? So my question to you is, you've framed the argument as would be dangerous. Why do you not also frame the argument or would be futile or would inhibit the effective investigation of the crime?
Because in the trial court, the only argument that was made to the trial court was based on the danger aspect of it. The prosecutor argued that even though there was no information on weapons, it's still sufficient to show danger. And since the state lost in the trial court, I felt that we were bound by the arguments made to the trial court, and we could not raise arguments in addition to those that were presented to the trial court when the court ruled on the suppression motion.
Counsel, let's say that in this one, there have been many, many cases that said that people that deal drugs sometimes have guns. There was testimony as to that. Now, is one of the problems here because there were no guns found? Say there were guns. Now, would that have made a difference?
No, whether guns are found or not should not make a difference. I mean, what's been known before the entry is made that can be used to justify the no-knock entry.
And the officers didn't know. I mean, there was one that testified based on his experience that, and that's what I was referring to, that people that deal in drugs have guns, which he testified to, but there were none here, and there was no experience, at least for these people in the arrest record, that they had used guns.
That's right. We didn't know ahead of time about these people having guns, and their arrest record did not connect them to weapons.
Their arrest record said assault, right?
Correct.
And they were, this was in Illinois? Somehow I got the impression.
One of them
assault under Illinois law?
Pardon me?
Assault on, and it was arrest, not conviction.
Correct.
No convictions.
None that's mentioned in the affidavit.
Okay. So now we got assault. So what constitutes assault under the Illinois law? Well, what I'm getting at, it could be loud speaking, can't it?
Well, yeah, it's engaging in conduct that puts someone else in apprehension of receiving a battery.
Could be a threat.
Could be, yes.
Could be loud, boisterous activity. Flailing of arms.
Well, I assume so. I mean, I'm not sure totally what the sufficiency evidence is in Illinois, but...
So you don't know that, so that you assume the magistrate didn't know that and the affiant didn't know that?
No, but I think for the reasonable standard, for reasonable suspicion, we don't have to eliminate all innocent conduct or stuff that would be short, conduct short of showing danger. I mean, as long as it's susceptible to an inference, as long as you can draw an reasonable inference that it provides the reasonable suspicion, then it's there.
But there's no inference that it was armed. No inference from the arrests.
Just assault wouldn't necessarily show armed, no.
What about the obstruction of justice? There were two or three, as I recall. Is that enough in itself? What involves obstruction of justice? Was that a conviction or simply...
That was also an arrest. Right. And I think that, if the argument raised, I would have gone, I think, too strong to show if the person's going to interfere with a police officer, that they may well go destroy the evidence. But here I have to couple that with the fact that the person is also, that same person had been arrested for assault. So someone who's willing to interfere with the police officers and is willing to at least engage enough conduct that other people would be in fear of battery, I think it contributes to a showing of reasonable suspicion of danger. And especially that couple, again, with the police officer's experience about the use of weapons by when these search warrants are executed.
But what's the state want out of this case? The state could want here that an arrest record, arrest, no conviction, arrest, is sufficient to establish reasonable suspicion for a no-knock.
Yes, that's one thing. That's one of the steps along the way.
You don't want a rule of law that says can't use arrest records.
Right.
Okay. Do you want to establish the rule of law that an arrest for an assault without any information about the nature of the assault? Assault doesn't mean battery. It could, but it doesn't necessarily.
It means it puts someone else in apprehension of receiving battery.
Right.
But it doesn't mean the battery has occurred.
Right. So do you want a rule that says an arrest for assault is adequate for a no-knock?
Yes, because that's...
That's the rule of law you want. Okay. Now, what was the time differential between the getting the warrant and the actual search?
I'm afraid I don't know. I think it was within a day or so.
I think...
Pardon? April 27th, I believe, the warrant is dated, and May 1st it was executed.
Okay, I have May 1st as the execution.
Check that.
Yeah, the...
Because what I'm going to get at is a time differential. And that is, as I understand it, it was executed May 1, 1998.
The warrant says dated this 28th day of April, 1998, and then the signature.
27th day, I believe.
Well, they have two dates. So the filled-in date, the handwritten date says received April 27th, and the other one says date 20. So it's got to be one of those days, 27th.
So we got, depending on what the count is, 2, 3, 4 days here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you execute a warrant on a no-knock, if you have a no-knock warrant, does that mean that if there's been a change in circumstance, you still can go in with a no-knock?
Not necessarily. Depends on what the change is. If the change in circumstance eliminates the concern for the danger, no, then you could not.
So here, there was no such change. Is that your argument?
Right. I mean, the affidavit was based on the kind of information that was not going to change between the issuance of the warrant and the execution.
Counsel.
And no other facts changed here so that they would have other facts to go in on a no-knock?
There's nothing in the record of a change, no.
So they could do that if they had other facts, even if they had a warrant that required knocking.
Right. I mean, if new facts, I mean, if they knew nothing to begin with, but then they learned stuff at the last minute.
Well, they did know, just correct me if I'm wrong, that they were dealing, this was a confidential informant, right, that was involved here? Is that in this case?
Yeah, I think there'd been I'll have to check again for sure on that.
Did they know what kind of drugs they were dealing with?
They were looking for cocaine.
Yeah, and cocaine is a drug, or I think in this case it was crack, that could be very easily disposed. In other words, sometimes they even keep it around the bathroom toilet so that it can be flushed, or they have a bucket of lye so they can dump it in there and it's gone.
Right.
So getting into that place quickly was very important.
Yes, it was.
You're not basing your argument on that.
No, again, as I explained before, I respond to Justice Bradley because it wasn't raised in the front.
Why do you abandon the deference that needs to be shown to the issuing magistrate?
I didn't believe I'd abandon that.
Well, it is absolutely clear that the affidavit says these persons will destroy or conceal evidence of given time. That was presented to the magistrate. The argument before the circuit judge was by defense counsel, there's no specific information in this affidavit that property would be destroyed. The issue was before the trial court.
Well, I certainly, if I can make the argument, I certainly will, because especially with the obstruction arrest for Shannon Eason, that's certainly someone who's going to interfere with the exercise of the officer's authority is, I think, an indication that that person would have no hesitancy to destroy something like cocaine, which would be very easy to get rid of. So I think that, coupled with the officer's statement, certainly would provide reasonable suspicion on that ground.
I don't mean to interrupt, but that's what I was driving at. In other words, the magistrate, the person that issued the warrant, knew about that, and what was read by Justice Prosser was part of what he knew and part of what was in the no-knock warrant. Now, you couple that with the Illinois arrest record, the obstruction of justice. So here he had allegedly had people that were dealing with this type of drug and had allegedly had this obstruction of justice. But that's what I'm saying. What criteria are you looking for when the magistrate who has to issue this would be faced with these rather sterile facts, but he or she knew what...
Well, I certainly think there was sufficient information for the magistrate to issue it on for the grounds that you and Justice Prosser just stated and what I was stating there, coupling the arrest of obstruction, the destruction of the fact cocaine was the drug, cocaine could easily be destroyed, and the officer's experience that people try and destroy those.
Well, we know people will destroy evidence if they get caught and they have enough time. But usually in these destruction cases, you want to know, it's usually something is given, like, I was in the house 3 days ago and there was a bucket. Or last time, he told me that they're set to destroy it by flushing the toilet. First of all, you have to have very little, because if you have too much, it will clog up. But you usually have something that tells you that. Now, if you move from the argument on dangerous from assault, now let's move to obstruction of justice. You don't know what he did, right?
When you don't know what who did.
Why he was arrested. No,
for obstruction, you mean?
Right.
No, right. That's not it.
It could have been that he walked away from a police officer. Refused to give him his name.
At least in Wisconsin, I don't think he would be charged with obstruction for that. But.
Maybe. I might be charged, might not be convicted. Not giving the correct name.
That could be, yes.
Yeah, we think we had a case on that one. So we don't know what he does.
No, but again, I think if put all these factors together about someone who's willing to not cooperate with the police, in fact, not maybe beyond, could be well be beyond not cooperation, could be providing misleading information.
But it was no conviction.
Well, we don't know. The record doesn't show it. So I can't say there's no conviction, but there wasn't informed.
There's no basis in the record for a conviction.
Right. We don't.
Okay. So is it the state's position that if there is arrest for obstruction, then that justifies no knock?
Well, especially when you're talking about cocaine, which can be destroyed, yes, it is. I mean, there are other cases. We have cited some that have cited arrest records as basis for making no-knock entries. And I think that's consistent also with, I mean, to use an arrest record, even if we don't know about the conviction, is consistent. I mean, people can be sent, if for sentencing purposes, where people will be sending away for, lose their liberty for a long period of time, courts consider even acquitted crimes, unproven offenses, and so forth, when they want to learn the character of the person.
Or other acts evidence. Doesn't even have to be arrest.
Yes.
And that would be used, given to the jury and convict. So
I think this kind of evidence is reliable enough to establish the reasonable suspicion standard, which is a pretty, the U.S. Supreme Court said in Rich, should be a pretty easy standard to achieve.
Yeah. Can you lower the bar below this? For reasonable suspicion?
No, I mean reasonable.
Anything less than this, would that satisfy reasonable suspicion?
Less than what's in this case? Actually, I don't know. I mean, I can't conceive of all the possible circumstances that may come up. I think when you have an arrest record for an individual, though, I mean, that's indication that obviously authorities thought there was sufficient action to take that step, and arrest is supposed to be probable cause. So,
Mr. Kleinmeier?
Yes.
I'm somewhat confused by a couple of your responses to the Chief Justice. At one point she asked, what rule of law do you want to come out of this case? And you said essentially that arrest records were sufficient to establish reasonable suspicion, at least these kinds of. And then just a few moments ago you said, coupled with the potential destructiveness of evidence. And that raises in my mind a question that I thought I had answered in my preparation for this case, and that is, what are the facts that the state is relying on to establish reasonable suspicion? Coming into this argument, I felt that the state was relying on the prior arrest records, which would establish potential dangerousness to the officers, as well as potential destructiveness of evidence. I thought you would rely on, although you've not mentioned it a whole lot, the officer's prior experience, because in Myers, we specifically said that can be taken into account with all the factors. So my question is, what are the facts that you are relying on to establish reasonable suspicion to go in there without knocking and announcing?
Okay, I'm sorry, for the confusion. I think it's all the facts taken together.
What are those facts?
The arrest records, which can't, I think, can be considered. But the arrest records can be considered, and the experience of the officer, the fact cocaine was involved. I think those are the main facts in this case, especially when they're put together. I don't think we really have to consider what the result would be if we had only one, because the fact is here we have them all. Kind of related to this is that, the Ornelas case, the U.S. Supreme Court was talking about the standard review for probable cause and reasonable suspicion, whether it should be, just deference for findings of fact by the trial court or whether it's de novo. They said de novo, and this provides some guidance for other cases. And I said, however, in any individual case, it may not actually, provide direct precedent for any subsequent one, which is kind of the situation here. I mean, in the sense that for a rule of law, I guess the rule of law I would like is that arrest records can be considered in finding reasonable suspicion. Whether arrest records alone would be sufficient would probably depend on the individual case and what was in those arrest records. But I think they certainly should be one of the factors that can be considered along with everything else.
Well, counsel, could you think?
One follow-up.
Yeah, go ahead.
And could you elaborate a bit on the police officer, the affiant's prior knowledge, and what role that plays in this case?
Well, I think it helps play a role on, especially giving some meaning to the particular facts. I mean, the officer could examine. Using his experience, his or her experience, and examine the particular facts, more particular facts here being the arrest records of these people and what the danger that then poses to the officer.
Counsel, Justice Bradley, I read you on the bottom of page 7 of your brief, and we're talking about the Richards case. But just so I understand your answer, in order to justify a no-knock entry, that's what we're talking about. This is a United States Supreme Court case. The police must have reasonable suspicion that knocking and announcing their presence under the particular circumstances would be dangerous or futile, or that it would inhibit the effective investigation of the crime by, for example, allowing the destruction of evidence. This standard, and then slash, as opposed to the probable cause requirement, strikes the appropriate balance between legitimate law enforcement concerns at issue in the execution of search warrants and individual privacy interests affected by no-knock entry. This showing is not high, but the police should be required to make it whenever the reasonableness of a no-knock entry is challenged. So as I understand your argument, you're saying, in answer to the various questions, that in this case, at least one or more of those instances were there, the futility, the dangerousness, or inhibit the infect the under this particular circumstance would inhibit the effective investigation of the crime. So that would be caused by the various things which we've all mentioned. Are we talking about a kind of a, I don't want to use the word totality, but you're talking about at least two or three different, the testimony of the officer, the drugs, and the arrest record.
Yes.
Counsel, I am mindful that oral argument is a movable and flexible event. But my very first question was, what are you arguing? Let's take a look at your brief, because your first two or three sentences out of your mouth reiterated the way that you had set forth the argument and that you developed the argument in this brief. And that's what I focused in on in my very first question. And you said, nope, we're only arguing dangerousness. And I asked you why, and you said, because we feel we are bound by that. What rule of law, or what caused, and I didn't push you on your response, but let me now further develop your response. Why, up until maybe 5 minutes ago, did you feel, or what causes you to feel that you are bound to advance only the dangerousness argument? What rule of law?
Well, I think normally the courts say that the party who loses in the trial court when they appeal are bound by waiver rules, or prevented by waiver rules from raising issues and arguments that weren't raised in the trial court before the judge that made the decision. Now, the waiver rules can obviously be also in addition waived by the appellate courts, and the court can go on to look at other issues that are in the case, as demonstrated by the questions about what the information that was in the affidavit and which was before the magistrate.
So unless the court wants to, and the court can, reach out and answer these issues, the court certainly has the discretion to do that. But from your point of view, as a rule of law, you are bound by the record in the trial court and the arguments advanced and the waivers made.
I think unless this court lets me get past the waiver, yes, because it wasn't raised before the trial judge.
Counsel, you're resting your argument on three legs: arrests, officers' experience, and that it's cocaine. The officers' experience here related generally to drugs, right? Didn't relate to people who have been arrested for assault.
Well, most of the stuff in this affidavit were related to his experience involving drug cases, yes.
Right. So anything special in it, but it's saying that to him, on the basis of his experience, that those who have been previously arrested for assault or for obstructing justice are more likely to have arms or destroy it?
He didn't make that statement, no.
So his was a general experience, and good experience, that people who have drugs and will have arms because they're protecting valuable property, expensive property, or money that they've collected, right?
Yes, and they also don't want to get arrested.
What?
And they probably also don't want to get caught.
Yeah, that's general. I mean, it doesn't have to be drugs, right? Traffic speeding, you don't want to get caught either.
Well, except the I think you'd have to have a real distorted mind to use arms against a police officer who wants to arrest you for traffic speeding.
Oh, you know, traffic offenses, when people are stopped for traffic, that's the most, one of the most dangerous things for officers. They're killed that
But
way,
I think that person's usually...
As well as domestic violence.
I think when the traffic arrest is usually the traffic arrest reason for the stop, but I think that person's concerned about something beyond
so
the traffic.
So the officer's experience are generally on the issue of drugs, right? Nothing special about the arrests.
From the officer's experience, right.
And the concept that this is cocaine, that's general experience, too, as to cocaine.
Yes.
Now, if the testimony was only as to officers' experience generally as to drugs, and that this was cocaine, would that be enough under the Richards case?
Under Richards and Meyer, no, it would probably not be enough, because the court has said that's too general.
So what you have, then, the triggering has to be the arrests, because the two others are not enough.
That's the particular circumstances of this case, yes.
Thank you. You never got to the other two major issues. Maybe you'll cover them in your 5 minutes. Thank you, counsel. Ms. Agopian, who represents Mr. Eason, and Ms. Agopian is Assistant State Public Defender.
Thank you. This case is about the privacy of our homes. The rule of announcement may date from the 15th century, but it's every bit as important today as it was then and as it was when these Northwoods were settled. It guarantees that unless there are exigent circumstances, the police must first knock and announce their presence and allow us an opportunity to answer, to perhaps get out of bed, put on clothes, and allow them to enter peacefully. If this court buys the state's arguments today and agrees that this warrant was good enough to justify a no-knock entry, there is really nothing left of the rule of announcement. At the same time, if this court agrees with the lower courts that this warrant...
Why is that? Why do you make that statement? That seems to be a rather broad statement when is your argument that reasonable suspicion for a no-knock should be based on there was an arrest record here. You know there was cocaine. There was the officer's testimony. That's not unusual testimony in a request for a no-knock warrant. What is gutting the whole thing then?
The only particularized information here is the arrest records. And the arrest records are utterly unenlightening as to either dangerousness or the destruction of evidence.
They may be unenlightening as to those two, but this guy's got a number of arrests. This guy is not a good citizen, unless he's very unlucky to repeatedly get arrested and it's the wrong person or that they don't have enough goods on him. So you got a bad actor here. Why isn't that enough? I mean, I'm all for protection of the home, but we got a very dangerous drug situation out there. And this occurred where? What county?
This was in Rock County.
Rock County, okay. Right across the border from Illinois.
Correct.
It wouldn't matter. Could be anywhere in the state, right?
Right.
Drugs are everywhere.
Sure.
Right. Well, and then you got a bad actor, right?
Well, we have... I mean, one of the individuals, it was a 9-year-old arrest for one offense. It was one arrest. The other individual had multiple arrests, most of which were larceny, property offenses.
That's not being a good actor.
Not a good actor.
But he was arrested the year before the warrant was issued.
Who was?
Clinton Bentley.
Clinton Bentley? I do not recall that.
Well, that's where he got the address. It's in the affidavit.
But he was arrested the year before for a drug offense?
It didn't say what it was for, but he was arrested.
Well, I think the problem here is whether the individual is, in other cases, they've said this individual is a career criminal. But that isn't the sort of particular information that is enlightening in terms of whether that individual is going to pose a danger to the police entering a home to execute a warrant.
Counsel, just in the affidavit, this is on page 126 of the blue brief, it talks about what the police knew, and they had a confidential informant who had a drug buy. Isn't this standard language? I'm talking about for the type, they knew what type of situation they were going into, that the affiant states he was familiar with the confidential files, that he knew that the Beloit Police Department had received two pieces of intelligence indicating that Mr. Bentley, the one that is a drug dealer, and they knew that at the time.
Sure, but that would all go to, you know, probable cause for the warrant, and that provides some information, but it's not much better, you know, this warrant is not much better than the blanket rule. The particular information is the arrest history, and that is not enlightening because of what was discussed previously. An assault is something less than a battery. It's threatening words while making any sort of gesture, waving your fingers around. And it's a 9-year-old incident. We don't know if there was a conviction. The other individual assaults, again, these are misdemeanors, no disposition, no date. You know, I think the reason I feel confident in saying that this would not survive review at a higher level is because when you look at the cases that have considered what dangerousness means, they are looking at much more than they had here. We've had cases, even the cases that the state cites, for example, Thompson versus Maher, a situation where the individual was a career criminal. That wasn't enough. What was important to the court was that there was information that within a year the individual had committed an armed robbery, that in a prior arrest the individual had reached for a gun and had a prior weapons offense. Those facts are so significant because they provide reasonable grounds to believe that that individual has weapons and is willing to use them, either in the commission of crimes or against the police. I think we have to remember the context here. We're not talking about a lone officer approaching an unknown individual on a street. We're talking about officers armed and ready for confrontation. They're going to execute a warrant. This means a SWAT team is around the house. They're in armor. They've got automatic weapons.
Wait a minute, counsel. This wasn't, I mean, this, the facts you're reciting, that wasn't, was that in this case?
Well, I don't know if they're wearing armor.
Just because what I wanted to ask you is that, are you saying that it's fine to use an arrest record, but you would want to know the details that, especially from Illinois or some other state, of whether at the time this person was arrested that he had a gun, and would that have been sufficient then if you had the arrest record and then it said, and he had a gun at the time? In other words, is it a lack of detail in this arrest record?
Yes, that's precisely the problem.
So if there was that much, there was a gun, that would have been sufficient.
Well, again, I don't think we can adopt any other sort of blanket rule. I mean, it all depends on the particular facts. But yes, if the individual had had a gun in his possession during a prior arrest and he reached for it, I think that's very compelling. Now, we also get into, well, how long ago did that happen? But, you know, the more compelling the facts are in terms that the person has guns and is willing to use them against the police, I think staleness becomes a little bit less of a concern.
Well, you'd be arguing that in 89, if he had a gun and he used it, it would still be stale for this case.
I could cite to authority that would say that that is stale.
Ms. Hagopian, what is it that you wanted the police to do in this case? Lay it out for me. You want them to knock on the door, right? They've got a search warrant.
Sure.
You want them to knock at the door, correct?
I want them to knock and announce.
And announce what?
And announce police search warrant.
Okay, for drugs or just search warrant?
Search warrant.
And
open
then,
up.
And
open
then
up.
Open up. And then what do you want them to do?
I want them to wait.
How long?
Well, the law doesn't require a long period.
30 seconds?
There isn't any magic number. It depends on the circumstances.
Well,
but we're talking seconds.
Seconds. Okay, now here you've got probable cause to believe that drug dealing is going on in that house, right? You
yes.
Don't contest that.
That's correct.
And you've got some people inside that house that have at least been arrested in the past for various crimes. It could indicate obstruction of justice, et cetera. That's
we have
fact.
One individual with that history.
And then doesn't the other individual have some arrest records, too?
Yes, but that's the 9-year-old aggravated assault. No yeah. history of obstruction for that individual.
And then you as a police officer know that in these cases there's a great danger usually of destruction of evidence or danger to the police officers as a general rule.
Sure.
Well, then I guess I put it to you the same way I put it in a concurrence or a dissent I wrote a couple years ago. Would you want, if you were a police officer, would you want to be the first one through that door after knocking, saying, hello, we're the police, I've got a search warrant, and then sit back and wait 10 seconds or 30 seconds?
You know, I feel very comfortable being the first officer through that door, and I'll tell you why. Because, like I said, I'm not a lone officer. I've got a group of officers with me. We're armed. We're ready for a confrontation. We have had a confidential informant in that apartment within 72 hours, and there's been no indication of any weapon in that home. There's no indication of Mr. Bentley ever possessing or using a weapon. Same with Shannon Eason. I would feel very comfortable entering that home. You know what I would be concerned about? I would be concerned about our manner of execution posing a danger to people in that home, including the small children who are present.
Mr. Gopian, why shouldn't we just look at this case in terms of the fact that there's a search warrant? It's a no-knock search warrant. The officers are acting on the basis of that warrant in good faith. They enter the home and execute that warrant. Why doesn't State versus Ward apply here? What is the difference between this case and State versus Ward, in your opinion?
What you're opposing there is an adoption of the good faith exception.
What did
which
we do
we did,
in State versus Ward?
Well, I think the court very judiciously avoided adopting the good faith exception. What it said it was doing was adopting an exception that applies in a very narrow band of cases in this unusual circumstance where the police, the lower courts, were following what this, the highest court of the state, said was the law at that time.
How is this case different in essence from State versus Ward? There we said the officers were acting in good faith based on a warrant that had been issued based on an earlier decision by this court. Here you've got a warrant. The warrant is a search warrant. It allows for no knock. The officers are acting in good faith. What's the difference?
Well, if the court is going to adopt the good faith exception, which would require, I mean, that's what we're talking about here then, adoption of the good faith exception, that I think the court needs to appreciate the enormity of that step. The Ward may have moved us somewhat in that direction. The next step is a leap, because what that would mean is whenever police are relying on a warrant that does not have probable cause, we're not going to apply the exclusionary rule. That is a dramatic departure from what has been the law in this state for 80 years, and Wisconsin has a unique and valued history in terms of protecting the privacy of the home, and it has protected it by a use of the exclusionary rule, which we have had in place 40 years before MAP said we needed to. And I would sincerely ask if the court is going to contemplate taking the leap of the good faith exception, that it only do that after reexamining the history of the exclusionary rule in this state. I know that in Ward he said we don't need to revisit Tompkins and Tompkins dicta, saying that the exclusionary rule is a mere judicial remedy, not a personal right. And I would submit that Tompkins is wrong, and I'll give you three reasons. One is Tompkins says that Hoyer, the seminal case, was relying only on federal authority. That's not right. Hoyer also cited state authority. And I think a more fair reading of Hoyer is that Hoyer was not following any particular authority. What the court was trying to do is ascertain what our Constitution means. It was interpreting our Constitution.
Don't you think that Hoyer was a result of Weeks versus U.S.? Don't you think our court in Hoyer was looking at what the U.S. Supreme Court had done and decided that we ought to have the same rule under our Constitution?
I would submit that that's probably true, as well as looking at other authorities. But what I think is important is we should all reread Weeks, because Weeks is light years away from Leon's. Weeks treated the exclusionary rule as a personal right mandated by the Constitution. And the purpose of the exclusionary as used by the Supreme Court in Weeks was way beyond deterring police misconduct. Weeks reads very much like Hoyer. So when this court issued the decision in Hoyer, I don't think it's reasonable to say that we were then forever signing on to every permutation and change that the U.S. Supreme Court might come up with. I think it's reasonable to say that we were influenced by Weeks. But Weeks is so different than Leon. The U.S. Supreme Court got to Leon through a process of constitutional revisionism. And I would ask...
we generally taken the same approach as the U.S. Supreme Court has in regard to Fourth Amendment issues? Don't our cases repeatedly indicate that?
We have in many other circumstances, and I think in some other circumstances it makes more sense. I mean, if we're setting out standards, for example, of what is reasonable suspicion of exigency, I think there may be some point in having consistency for the federal and state law enforcement. But when we're talking about the exclusionary rule, that's a standard applied by the courts, not the police officers. I think we can be perfectly comfortable having a broader exclusionary rule than the federal courts employ. And in fact, we've done exactly that for 17 years. You know, Leon has now been on the books for 17 years, and we have functioned without a good faith exception, and I would submit that things are going very well.
Well, I just ask this now. Other states do have the good faith exception, some other states. In other words, it's not only Wisconsin and in this recent case in the federal. And are we to take account and say, well, do we want to be in the majority or the minority? And in this case, we had an allegedly invalid search warrant. But as far as the police were concerned, well, they went in there with what they thought was a valid no-knock warrant. And does that give any more impetus to having a good faith exception in this case?
Well, let me address the first point in terms of do we do a head count. I don't think that's a good way to make these decisions, but if we did a head count, we'd find that if we rejected the good faith exception, we would be with the vast majority. And in addition,
states.
A vast majority of states, that's right. 14 states have rejected, 12 have done so on state constitutional grounds. And I think one of the factors we need to insert in there is that Wisconsin was one of the earliest states to recognize the exclusionary rule so that, you know, we have this strong basis to reject it on state constitutional grounds. Now, the second aspect of your question, the police relying here on warrants saying there were exigencies, you know, I think in particular the situation of a no-knock request is something that it is reasonable to expect the police to have an idea what the law is, because this is the kind of thing where they're coming to the magistrate saying that we believe there's danger, and the burden is on them to show why. And so we would expect them to know that the law says we don't have a blanket rule, you have to provide particularized information, danger, that typically means firearms. You know, I think that particularly with the no-knock situation, it's reasonable to expect the police to know the law and to meet that standard and bring it to the magistrate.
So what you're saying is that the police then would have to know the law, and the magistrate, quote, made the mistake. And what if they went there and the magistrate said, well, in this case, I'll give you one. No, we think maybe we don't have the law on our side. I think that's expecting too much of the police. That's why they go to a neutral magistrate to present the evidence. And the fact that this court is going back and forth shows you it's not a clear-cut question, particularly when we talk about no-knock, where there were so-called exigent circumstances without a warrant, but here you had a warrant. And that's what I was trying to point out, that here you had a warrant, which may be more justification for a good faith exception.
Well, I think the law has been more complicated in this state because we, for a time, had the blanket rule. When you look at the law across the country, it really is very clear. It's very clear what dangerousness means. I mean, in Ramirez, the court found an exigency of dangerousness, the U.S. Supreme Court did, and there was information, they were looking for a prison escapee, and there was information that this individual had access to a large supply of weapons, and there was information that this individual had said he would never do federal time, and he had previously threatened the police and witnesses. See, this is the kind of particular information that shows there's reason to believe that this person has guns and is willing to use them against the police. And I think that's not difficult for the police to understand. And I think the same holds true with the theory of destruction of evidence. We need some particularized information. There's reason to believe the person is likely to destroy evidence.
You know, the problem with the argument, and it's a good legal argument, and you're reciting the law as least as I understand it. The problem is, it doesn't make good common sense. It doesn't make good common sense for the reason that Justice Babbage said. That is, the officer should be afraid. I mean, that's good common sense. You're going into a house where the people sell drugs, have every reason not to want to be arrested, have every reason want to protect themselves and their property, illegal property, and they'll do what's needed, whether it be punching or hitting, which can be deadly, or use, doesn't even have to be a gun or a knife, it could be some heavy object that's in the house, and the officer is afraid, and why shouldn't the officer take any measures the officer needs in order to reduce the danger to that officer? I mean, in ride-alongs and domestic violence, you enter into home, you don't know what is there. You don't know who's there, what's there, and if you're not afraid, frankly, you're in front of law enforcement officers who are trying to do the job for the peace in this community and, or any community, and we put blocks in and we say, oh no, you can't do that because you have to have an articulable suspicion. But the suspicion is, I'm afraid of everybody. And you're supposed to be afraid of everybody. You don't know where danger lurks, so you're always on guard. And so that the law just does not take that into account, and that's what the fight's about.
Well, I would acknowledge that being a police officer is a dangerous job, and virtually any police citizen encounter involves danger.
That's right.
But danger, you know, it's part of the job, and it also has to line up against the privacy of our homes and what the Constitution protects. And, you know, if we're willing to discard those personal liberties, then, I mean, where do we draw the line?
Well, maybe we should discard it. Maybe we should take the position that police can enter the home without articulable, particularized suspicion about these particular people, just on general terms, and use the evidence, good faith. And what we should do is then, if the police make a mistake, you give them money, you give the people whose homes have been wrongfully entered money. State pays.
Yes, and you know,
not the police officer, because the officer worked on a warrant and should not have to look behind the warrant. Maybe you have to get rid of a little judicial immunity for the magistrate who made a mistake. Or maybe you just don't do anything, you just say the state pays. If there was an error, the state pays, and that's cheap. It's better to pay than to lose a life.
Well, I guess setting aside for the moment that that would mean we've repealed the Fourth Amendment and Article 1, Section 11. I mean, that experiment was tried.
But an underlying premise to the Chief Justice.
Sorry, when was it tried?
It was tried during this period between the Wolf decision in 1949 and the Mapp decision in 1961. In Wolf, the court did not impose the exclusionary rule under the 14th Amendment on the states. And part of its rationale was we want the states to experiment with other remedies. But by the time of Mapp, they decided those remedies didn't work.
Excuse me, Ms. Hagopian, but underlying the Chief's presentation to you, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Chief, is that there has already been established probable cause to believe that drug dealing is going on in the building.
Sure. And if we've got probable cause for drug dealing and are going to allow a no-knock entry, we're back to the blanket rule.
We're back to Richards.
We're back to Richards, which we can't do that. I would like to, for a moment, just...
I ask one question. There is a paragraph in the affidavit about drawing on the training experience of the officer. He's saying that when you have a drug house, in effect, other people show up there. Is that a boilerplate paragraph in these affidavits?
It's written as though it's a boilerplate paragraph. I mean, there isn't any particular information about when this informant was previously in the home about groups of people being there. And the paragraph also that talks about the officer's experience, that also is written as boilerplate, and it's enormously broad. I mean, it talks about he's aware that persons involved in many illegal activities, and then I'm skipping down, are often armed themselves and are likely to use them, and these people will destroy evidence. I mean, taken at face value, what they're saying is anyone who has any sort of arrest records, despite the nature of them, is likely to destroy evidence, is likely to have arms and use them. And that is not the kind of particularized information that Richards requires.
If I may, there was probable cause for this search warrant, was there not?
Yes.
If there hadn't been a no-knock entry, what would have happened?
If there had not been a no-knock entry, then they would have complied with both the Fourth Amendment and our Constitution.
What would they have found?
They would have found exactly what they found. I mean, it wouldn't have changed. They found drugs. They found no firearms. They found cocaine, I believe 12.5 grams, and they found some marijuana.
So it would be your view that none of that would have been destroyed?
That it would not have been destroyed.
So it was almost inevitable that they'd find it, is that right?
If the court here is tossing out the inevitable discovery doctrine, that doctrine requires independent investigations, and an independent source requires two independent searches. We have one search, one investigation, one warrant. This causal relationship test is utterly incompatible with what the U.S. Supreme Court said in Wilson, that this is part of the reasonableness inquiry.
Well, let me ask this. There were 8 people in that apartment, isn't that correct?
That sounds right.
And you have cited the amount of drugs that were found. If there had been knocking and announcing, don't you think that the people who actually had drugs on their person would have thrown it somewhere or hidden it somewhere or destroyed it? And then how would you link the drugs to one of the persons inside?
Well, I would be completely speculating on what they would have done because I don't have any particularized information that shows me a pattern of behavior of these individuals. I know that there were children in the home. Shannon Eason may have been playing with those children, changing a diaper. She may have been in no position to destroy the drugs. Well, you know why that's important, Your Honor? Is because we don't have any information that they had a plan. We don't have any information that they kept those drugs by the toilet.
Because of some of that crack in the diaper.
Well, you know, but see, this is the problem. We're speculating. We need, if we're going to allow the police to rely on this sort of information as an exigency, we are just inches from a blanket rule because there is no enlightening, particularized information, either as to the prospects of the destruction of the evidence or as to the dangerousness of these individuals.
Also, what is the, just for the blanket rule you refer to, which Wisconsin has? Just tell me what you're talking about, just the blanket rule.
The blanket rule here would be that let me address it in terms of the destruction of the evidence, that any time the individual has ever had an arrest for obstructing, any time, we don't know the facts, we don't know anything about it, and we're executing a warrant for drugs, we're going to say you can do a no-knock entry.
What else is involved? Is a warrant involved in a blanket no-knock? Are you dealing with a warrant?
Well, in this case, we had a warrant. In another situation, you might not, and the police might come in after the fact and say, well, this no-knock was justified because we knew that at some point in history the person was arrested for obstructing.
Well, in the Richards case, which you refer to, when it puts the particularized circumstances in ORs, which is in the disjunctive, what is OR, for example, would allow the destruction of evidence? What does that mean, standing alone? Other than having dangerous or futile, what does the destruction of evidence mean?
Destruction of evidence would require particularized information that would give the police reason to believe that they would destroy evidence.
Okay, so if it had no indoor plumbing but it had an outhouse, would that have made a difference?
Well, you know, the courts have said that the fact that we do have indoor plumbing in and of itself is not going to justify.
You opened up your discussion talking about the North Woods, but this didn't happen in the North Woods. It happened.
There's plumbing in the North Woods.
I know. I live in the North Woods, and maybe we have less indoor outdoor plumbing. But the point is, here it was in Beloit. Here you had that question of destruction of evidence. So did that make any difference?
No, and you know, Your Honor, I think that this has not been argued below at any level by the district attorney. It wasn't contemplated. It was Judge Dahlberg, because nobody believed that this warrant was sufficient on that basis. If this had any hope, it was dangerousness, and I hope that I've convinced the court that it fails on that prong as well. You know, I would just ask the court to keep its eye on history as it decides this case. I ask the court to affirm the lower court's decisions and to affirm the principle that the statute of limitations has not run on our constitutional rights.
Counsel, you have one more question.
Before you sit down, counsel, just to clarify, first of all, we are confined to the four corners of the affidavit in evaluating the sufficiency.
Yes.
Okay. And the only particularized information in that affidavit is the arrest records of two of the occupants of the house, right?
That's right.
If these had been conviction records and those same offenses showed up as convictions, would that change your evaluation of this?
It would eliminate a little bit of the ambiguity, but it doesn't address the problem that it doesn't have particularized information showing dangerousness or likelihood of destroying evidence. It's too general.
Okay, so your objection is not only is it an arrest record and not a conviction record, but that you have to go behind the conviction
yes.
or the arrest in the affidavit and describe what the crimes were factually?
Yes, and in many cases, reliance on arrest records may be sufficient, but it's going to be when the arrest record shows the facts that relate to dangerousness or the other exigencies.
Does it have to be a history of weapons offenses, arrests or convictions, are other crimes of violence sufficient?
I think we can't have a blanket rule that way either, that it always has to be firearms, but that is virtually every case. There's a situation of the pit bull and a history of violence by that individual. I mean, you can imagine situations where the person may have bombs or spring guns in the house or something. I don't think we should say it always has to be firearms, but frankly, as a practical matter, that's what virtually every case is talking about.
What if it was an assault with a 2x4?
Well, yeah, you know, I think that's a good point. If there's particular information that this person keeps a bat near their door to guard their stash, that's enough.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Hagopian. Mr. Kleinmeier.
First of all, I'd like to correct or like go back to a question I think you gave me before, Chief Justice, about the experience of the police officer. He does, the affidavit does indicate experience in crimes other than drug dealing. Yeah. In page 128 of the appendix, the top paragraph says the affiant has been involved in investigations of other serious crimes, including but not limited to aggravated battery, burglaries, robberies, sexual assault, thefts, and child abuse offenses. So, I mean, I think this person, his experience dealing with the reactions of people other than just drug dealers, but people who are involved in other kinds of crimes.
Counsel, yeah. I want to follow up on the being restrained, the four corners of the affidavit, the only particularized information is with regard to the arrest warrant. Do you agree with that?
In this case, that's all we have. Is, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, we don't have any information.
In fact, that seems to follow from your statement that you made in terms of what you were seeking from this case. You were seeking a rule of law that arrest for assault is sufficient for reasonable suspicion, as I understood your comment before.
Yes, although in this case, it can be coupled with others. But.
Okay, let's say I have an 18-year-old daughter or son, and the 18-year-old is at a graduation party, let's say in the Wisconsin Dells area. And let's say the facts of that case indicate that my 18-year-old daughter or son was involved in an altercation and maybe not, wasn't telling the truth as to all the facts of the altercation. And so my 18-year-old daughter or son was arrested for either disorderly conduct, or let's be more specific, for battery, and arrested for obstruction. And a couple of years later, there is in an affidavit my child's arrest record that shows arrested for battery, arrested for obstruction, but with no underlying information as to the nature of those offenses. Is your rule of law that you're seeking then going to allow someone to knock down a door because there appears in an affidavit an arrest for not just assault, but battery and obstruction?
And this is a drug case I guess I'd have to know why the police officer is going to the door.
Securities fraud. And he's a bad actor.
They want something from in someone's desk. There might be some information.
So they have a search warrant for securities fraud case.
Sure.
And you have an affidavit says there's someone in that house that's been arrested for battery and been arrested for obstructing with no underlying information. Does that rule of law that you're seeking authorize the breaking down of that door of that house?
Yes, because I think that's enough to show that the person poses a threat to the danger of the police officers. So reasonable suspicion of that.
Do you change your answer, Mr. Kleinmeier, to my question that the officer's experience is on general matters and that that cocaine can be destroyed and that those two alone or either one of them alone would not suffice for a no-knock?
No, those general ones, I think, under Richards and...
And his affidavit would, taking out the arrest, would not be sufficient.
Correct, under Richards
and... I just want to know if you're rereading the affidavit change.
No, no, I just was looking for the one I had, just wanted to check on more on the police officer's experience. I couldn't remember everything on that. There were questions about the both the other kinds of arguments that we have made here about even if this affidavit wasn't sufficient so that the entry was in violation of the Fourth Amendment, then the question is you suppress the evidence. And the state has been at two arguments that it should not be suppressed. One, because there's this causal relationship test, which I don't think is at all inconsistent with Wilson v. Arkansas. In fact, It was raised in amicus briefs on Wilson v. Arkansas, and there's a footnote in Wilson v. Arkansas simply said it's not addressing that question because it wasn't raised in the petition for certiorari. If it had been completely inconsistent with Wilson, I think they would have just had a sentence in the opinion, you know, disregarding that theory, but it simply wasn't addressed, so I don't think we could convince
what was not addressed? I missed that.
The argument that the evidence shouldn't be excluded. The amicus briefs and Wilson argued that shouldn't exclude the evidence because there's no cause, inevitable discovery, no causal relationship, that kind of argument. The Supreme Court said it wouldn't address that because it wasn't for certiorari. Oh, my light is up.
Your causal relation, good faith.
Yeah.
Right. What about independent finding? Whatever the technical term is for finding it otherwise.
Well, see, that's where we... That's my causal relationship argument here. It's close to inevitable discovery and independent source, but I think it's even more basic than those because there's just no causal connection here.
It's all part of that causal. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Kleinmeier. Thank you, Ms. Hagopian. And that will conclude our hearing on State v. Eason.